Bismillah Rahman Rahim. Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me. And Mujeed, I must say that I feel a bit uneasy that I am speaking right after you, because I think I need time to digest what you have said. You are a scholar of a very high stature, and you have produced a superb book, outstanding, one of the finest studies that I have seen on the subject. It should be a must read for policy-making community in Pakistan and India both, and not just there, it should draw attention in major capitals around the world. You have, in your excellent sort of introduction, you have touched upon a number of things. I would just make one or two comments on that before what I want to say. It's not a question of that I am contradicting you, or but it's just a thought. That India and Pakistan, they were seeking some kind of what you call strategic independence when they pursued nuclear weapons. I can't say about India, but I think Pakistan's approach was somewhat reactive. We did not pursue, although we had option to pursue. For example, we could have got reprocessing plant in 1967. But we did not pursue that until 1974, when the Indians tested. The other thing I just thought crossed my mind, that in case Kashmir was resolved, a hypothetical supposition, would Pakistan be pursuing the nuclear option in that case? Because strategic independence is something quite different. That would have meant that whether Kashmir was resolved or not, etc., whether there were tensions between India and Pakistan, Pakistan should have pursued that. But nonetheless, I am just throwing this thing, this idea. The other thing is that the third parties are entrenched in the model. They will come. United States will come. Just a cautionary note, that it should not absolve us of our responsibility for de-escalation and to understand how dangerous we are to each other. That means Pakistan and India. You cannot rely on the third parties always and look up to them that they will come and they will salvage our situation. You have to do something yourself. Now, you are 100% right that whenever the third party is involved, and here the major party is United States, no doubt, then basically it is for the purpose of de-escalation and reduction of tension. No third party, no diplomacy, no intercession aims at fueling the flames. It is for de-escalation. Therefore, from a diplomat's point of view, I think this should always be welcome. This ought to be welcome. Pakistan, of course, during the Kargil crisis, you have mentioned several times, so Kargil crisis, we, I think, approached the United States. But mainly, in the beginning, to explain our position, whatever was our point of view. We also approached China, and that was more serious, and there China counseled us to respect line of control, which was basically a suggestion that vacate. So that I am in the case of the 2001-2002, the so-called Twin Peak crisis, the Chinese primarily endorsed our point of view, that yes, Pakistan is insisting on de-escalation, although Pakistan had to also mobilize its troops, and there was this eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation, but they endorsed our point of view that you are right, there should be de-escalation. I'll come to this kind of anatomy of this. I personally have seen from some close quarters, but there are people who know much better than myself, and Shamshad Sahib is here. I saw him. He was very much involved in the Kargil crisis. I was also there. We were in the Foreign Office at that time. My own view is that basically it is the endogenous, that you say, the two, the parties, that their decisions which count. In Pakistan, finally, also it was our decision that made the difference. And I'll tell you how. I think until the middle of June, until Sartaj Aziz Saab returned from Delhi, there were two points which were made by the, let me say, military architects of Kargil. One was that we can hold on to the positions that we have now, that is the Kargil, the sort of forward positions that we can hold on. India cannot dislodge us. The second point which was made was that if the conflict expands, we are in a position to defend every inch of Pakistan. These were the two positions. Now, with these two positions, even if there were doubts and all kinds of things, and there were at that time, it is extremely difficult for a political leadership to take the decision to retreat. Muslimanon mein waise bhi retreat ka zara bahut kam hai. To retreat, because it would have mounted that, look, we were capable of holding those, and that would have been avenging the Siachen. But this decision was taken. So, but then there are two things that happened. One was that by middle of June, Tololing complex, our positions started weakening, faltering. And the Indians were able to capture some of the peaks in that complex. And they were, our positions were becoming unsustainable. I don't want to go into details, but nonetheless, this was one. Second, Sartaj Aziz was sent with one hope that Indians would agree to some kind of a dialogue, which will also have Kashmir as one of the focus, and that Pakistan can then withdraw, that here is now a commitment. So this, but Sartaj Aziz Saab, he faced a stone wall in Delhi. He was told very bluntly that first you vacate, and only then we will think about talking to you. It was a very curt meeting. But the important thing again is that there were contacts during this period of crisis. There were contacts between Pakistan and India. Sartaj Saab could go. Now Sartaj Saab returned to Lahore, and here Mr. Nawaz Sharif held a high-level meeting at that time, in which the top military leadership and the civilian leadership were there. And I think one of the military, one among the military leadership, raised one question. And he said that, yes, if the conflict expands, we will be defending every inch of Pakistan. but the cost would be huge. And we will incur these costs for what? For a few peaks in Kargil. Now that, in a way, revealed or exposed the futility or untenability of the entire operation. That what are you doing? You want to have incurred these costs for what? So from then onwards, the situation changed. Then we were basically looking for a face saving. And we approached the Americans, because the Americans were in the best position, not the Chinese. Chinese don't have that kind of track record, or even that position. You are right, very much, that it is United States. And then, Nawaz Sharif went to Washington on 4th of July. The very fact that he went on 4th of July showed a certain degree of, desperation on our part, that we were seeking some kind of a... And finally, there was this agreement. I don't think that Mr. Nawaz Sharif was in a position to negotiate anything much. He wanted a face saving, and Mr. Clinton, he gave this assurance that he will personally involve and try to see that there is a dialogue. So, this is, I can talk about the other, the Twin Peak, there. I would say that, basically the world also understood Pakistan's position. Although any terrorist attack, etc., is an aberrant, act. So nobody has any stomach for that. But anybody could see that it was impossible for the Pakistan government to instigate this kind of an attack. Probably this attack on the parliament was that some of your the so-called non-state actors, etc., they got enthused by the 9/11 and they wanted to do something spectacular and went for that. Or, as some other people say, that this was a false flag operation. So whatever it was, the world could see that this is not a kind of thing in which Pakistan should be held culpable, in the same way that they could hold Pakistan culpable for the Kargil crisis. So here there was a kind of a different situation. Mumbai was quite different, and in Mumbai, right from the beginning, the Indians took one decision, and that was that they are not going to mobilize like they did in 2001-2002, but they are going to put Pakistan on the back foot everywhere in the world. And they succeeded in their strategies. Now, I say that, what is it, what are the lessons that we learn in a nuclear environment that we have now? The first thing that I would like to say is that militancy and activities of non-state actors or so-called drivers of sub-conventional conflict. This is a kind of thing for terrorist acts, as we say, sub-conventional, conventional to the nuclear. This is the trajectory which is talked about. They must be controlled and they must be countered. Today the question is not the denial of any policy of leveraging non-state actors. The world demands that every effort is made to check these elements and prevent terrorism. This is not simply a Western demand, but a universal call. This has to be understood. One can go, in a lot of details about this, but I'll not do that. We should understand that Kargil, the attack on Parliament, the Mumbai incident, have done great damage to Pakistan and the Kashmir cause. This has to sink in. On the other hand, India gained international sympathy and profile as a responsible nuclear weapon state. It would not be incorrect, and I think, Mohit, you have brought it out very, very well, in your book, that United States started leaning in favor of India since Kargil. And within less than a decade, the relationship transformed into a national alliance. Today it is that kind of relationship. Second, I think both countries, they should revisit dangerous doctrines that they have been formulating. These are not theoretical exercises. I think far more the future of this subcontinent is at stake. Cold start is a dangerous doctrine. It is inconceivable to defeat and humiliate a nuclear-armed country and army. The Indians had to realize that. Similarly, development of battlefield nuclear weapons, which by definition cannot be subjected to centralized control, is inherently risky. This brings into question our espousal of what we say now, full spectrum deterrence instead of the earlier minimum credible deterrence, where credible was the operative word and you could do whatever you wanted to do, whatever you needed to do under the word, under this credible. The change, to my mind, appears unnecessary and also not in sync with our capabilities. Perhaps only United States and Russia alone are on the technological frontiers where they can talk about a full spectrum, which involves space technologies, which involves cyber technologies, which involves many other things. So anyway, what I'm saying is that we should revisit these things again. Third, the hypothetical model of escalation, that is from subconvention or the terrorist incident to conventional conflict, which is the cold start, basically, to crossing the nuclear threshold, is insane. Diplomacy must interject every point of this trajectory. It may be third party, it may be the bilateral, etc. Okay, I'll wind up. Lastly, between two nuclear neighbors, in fact, you have told me to make it 10, 12 minutes. That's why. Otherwise, I would have compressed it in 7 minutes. Okay. Between two nuclear neighbors, bilateral dialogue and diplomatic contact must never be allowed to break down. All previous crises have this comforting aspect that even during the thick of these crises, there were active channels of communication. I have mentioned this thing. So, in peacetime, the nuclear environment demands that there should be some top-level military contacts, whether discreet or open. We have to see we are nuclear powers, therefore these things should not be taboo. Why should they be taboo? Future of the 1.5 billion people is at stake. I go a step further that the two countries should agree on regular bilateral summits, say once in 3 years, regardless of the state of relations between the two countries. The US and Soviet Union could have such summits. Why not Pakistan and India? These summits normally help to reduce tensions. We are not talking about here friendship with India. We are not even talking about normalization with India. What we are talking about is an arrangement that the two countries must institute by virtue of their being nuclear powers so that the crisis between these two countries are averted before they happen, or if they happen, they can be arrested. Thank you.